Section 15 of The Testament of Beauty by Robert Bridges. This Legimus recording may be freely used and adapted as long as Legimus and the reader are credited. Book 4, Ethic, Part 3. Since then all promise of spiritual advancement lieth in two things, good disposition and, as 'twas said, right education, it followeth here to speak of these. First, then, of disposition. Whether there truly be more good than bad absolutely in the make of man, there is no security for him, and little hope, except in the inherent harmony and unity of good, be such as must in the end outweigh the surplusage of all discordant enmity. And this well may be. But should we inquire if nature hath, by any means, incline man's disposition to the virtuous choice, we may find how she hath done this, and by the energy of the imitative faculty hath assured her end. For mimicry is inborn in man from childhood up, and in this differeth he from other animals, being the most imitative. And his first approach to learning maketh he in mimicry, and hath delight in imitations of all kinds. I would indeed that Aristotle had set this pregnant verity in forefront of his ethic also, as now 'tis found to establish his poetic. For the assumption of it here and there in the morals escapeth notice, and all the consequences thereof are unseen. But if the cradled child imitateth the shows that happen around him, he forsure will most attend to those that most attract, and must therefore be drawn and held by the inborn love of beauty inconsciently of preference to imitate the more beautiful things. And because virtue is an activity, and lieth not in doctrine and theory, but in practice and conduct, coordinating potencies into energy, and here 'tis Aristotle again speaketh, not I, the preferential imitation of right action is the habit of virtue. And thus a child, well-bred in good environment, so soon as he is aware of personality, will know and think himself a virtuous being, and instinctively, in the proud realization of self common to all animals, becometh to be his own ideal, a such a one as would will and do this, saith he, and never do that, refraining there from shame, consenting here for love, winning such new beauty of soul from the embrace of beauty, and strength by practised combat against folly and wrong, to perfect as he may his idea of himself. Spiritual life being thus imagined in the child, through conscient personality and love of beauty, which on so tender a plant budding hath power to bear the richest fruit of all creation, incomparable, there is naught in all his nature of more intrinsic need than is the food of beauty. As mammal's milk to his flesh, which admitteth no proxy, so beauty is to his soul, that calleth for this comforting of nature's breast, though its outcries be unheard when it pineth in pain. And since the hunger of mimicry is so strong in him, that in the lack of milk 'twill raven gall, and draw infection and death from evil as quickly as life from good, the first intrinsic need in education is found. Thus Christ, who knew what was in man, and taught man's happiness to be the wonted realm of heaven within his heart, spake thus. Take heed, he said, see that ye offend not one of these little ones. And once again in this wise, if there be any sin, unpardonable even in the wide compassion of God, 'tis the denial and blasphemy of his Holy Spirit, and the quenching in others of its nascent flame. Delicate and subtle are the dealings of nature, whereby the emotionable sense secretly is touched to awareness, and by glimpse of heavenly vision drawn within the attraction of the creative energy that is the ultimate life of all being soe'er, while science sitteth apart in her exile, attent on her other own invisibles, and working back to the atoms, she handleth their action to harness the gigantic forces of eternal motion, in serviceable obedience to man's mortal needs, and, not to be interrupted nor called off her task, dreaming, amid the wonders of her sightly works, through her infinitesimals, to arrive at last at the unsearchable immensities of goddess realm. But while the intellectual faculty is yet unborn, spiritual things to children are even as music is, that first-born pleasure of animal conscience that now hath for its human honour its origin forgot, the which a child absorbeth readily and without thought, though in after years, if that initiation have lacked, scarce can a man by grammar come at the elements. Their twain affinity may be seen also in this, that both accompanied by the same full delight of progress in performance, while the same method serveth for both, if but the teacher be himself virtuous or musical, an exemplar as such, he will be keenly followed, and often in his love that his pupil surpass him is his best reward. Of intellectual training 'tis not here to tell, that cometh later, and then the trouble is evermore the lack of teachers. Yet were teachers plentiful, and gentle environment as common as bramble scrub, never could human wit discern to accommodate the countless idiosyncrasies of mind withal. Indeterminable are they, and never can be told. But 'twere well to consider in what a fusty crypt the awakening mind is caged, when, like a butterfly that newly hath slipped its chrysalis to sport i' the sun, it thrusteth out its finely adapted tentacles in their first palping movements to the encounter of life, with confidence exploring its native yearnings. How, when this apprehensive expectancy is met by fenced obstruction? How, when even the syllables, which with such duteous pains the child had learned to tongue, the secret spell whereat the fabled treasure-house should open its doors, how, when that magic sesame hath proved a foreign jargon, and, like a rusty key, by long mishandling already hath hampered the lock? How should not childish effort, thus thwarted and teased, recoil, disheartened, bruised, and stupefied, beneath the rough-shot inculcation of inculcated minds, case-hardened by their own thoughtless reiterations? The mudfish may be happy and at home in the pond, but live imagination, conscient of its joy, ranketh oft with the dunces in such scholarship, finding its happiness in freedom to mature the personality of its native potency. Others, in aftergrowth, at heavy cost repair their early damage, since in intellectual things all errors are remediable. But 'tis not so in the spiritual life. Nay, even the soul, washed pure of absorbed taint, may take a strange gloss of the lie. Of two young thoroughbreds galloping neck to neck, I'd choose the colt that with least effort held his course. Of two runners abreast, my liking would crown him who had greater grace of limb and showed no trouble of face, though he by such complacency might miss the prize. But virtue in the soldier is the martyr's heart, that, battling for supremacy, outstayeth defeat, firing the citadel ere he yield it to the foe. And 'tis nobility that pulleth our favour upon the weaker side in any unequal match. Now, in spiritual combat, although I must deem them the most virtuous who, with least effort, excel, yet virtue being a conflict, moralizers hold that where conflict is hardest, virtue must be at best. And in the rub of life and physical hindrance, a man who has striven heroically and done great deeds, in spite of frailty or bodily disease or pain, may win more admiration and praise in the end than he who with comfort to himself, indolently, as it were, hath done as well. Nay, for the very impediments may even be envied, as old navigators were in the glory they had got to have outridden their storms. And yet, from Zion's hilltop to the Dead Sea shore, between the teachers sitting on the mount and them, the nethermost unfortunates that cannot learn, in all the mid-mass crowding on the flowery slopes, hearers of the word, there is little difference to be told. The same incarnate traitor routeth in all hearts. Nay, since 'tis an aesthetic delicacy of mind that, refining the enticement of carnal pleasure, voideth the shame, the elect are oft in straits extreme. The mastery of warriorship, their apparent grace, was won by discipline of deadly strife. In them ease is no indolence. Indolence, rather, is theirs who, ill-disposed to training, are unexercised in good habit of war. And 'tis the lack thereof maketh the soldier unready, and the conflict so hard, rather than any unwonted virulence or rage of the onslaught. For that same happeneth anon to all. And here my thought plungeth into the darksome grove and secret penetralia of ethic lore, wherein I have wandered often and long, and thought to know my way, and now shall go retracing my remembered paths, though no lute ever sounded there, nor muse hath sung deviously in the obscure shadows, and none follow me, entering where erst I entered, and all enter free at the great clearing made by Socrates of yore, when he said, "Know thyself." For true to his chief premise, that ignorance is the root of all men's folly, he taught to turn the lamp of reason inwardly upon the mind. And truly, with that keen
gnosis auton
of his was great felling of trees. For not Socrates knew, nor any hath ever kenned, how man thinketh, and less how thought thinketh itself,
nor how, in that province, reason hath right to rule,
nor of what stuff the reins can be, wherewith the charioteer bridled the steeds in that same vision of his which Plato saith he told to Phaedrus, as they sat together on the banks of the Ilissus, talking of the passions of men. End of section 15.